We want to alert you that some of the content you're about to hear in these podcasts could be upsetting and distressing. So please be aware, this may not be the right moment to listen. In this edition of Child Protection Committee Scotland podcasts, we're exploring the lasting effects of childhood abuse. Many adult survivors of abuse have spoken about the lifelong impact of being abused in childhood, impacts which include trauma, mental, emotional and physical health problems, difficulties with trust and relationship building, becoming dependent on alcohol or drugs, behaving recklessly, or living in a state of hypervigilance, to mention just a few. To give us an insight into how trauma of childhood abuse can manifest itself in later life and what we can do to support victims and survivors of abuse better, we invited three very special guests to join us. And I started off by asking them to introduce themselves.
So I'm Vicky Jeffries. I'm an adult survivor of childhood sexual abuse and I live with the effects of trauma.
Next.
I'm Giles Moffat. I'm also a survivor of childhood abuse and I'm a campaigner for child protection these days.
And finally, and last but not least.
My name's Leslie Ann Pratchett. I'm a psychotherapist. I work with an organisation called Break the Silence and we support adult survivors of abuse.
Thank you all for coming in. It's great to be able to have a conversation and learn stuff and just give people a perspective that they wouldn't have if they didn't hear this kind of conversation. So this is going to be pretty hard hitting. You guys know that more than me. I'm going to be learning a lot as well. So can I start with you, Vicky? You were a victim of sexual abuse. You are an abuse survivor. For many years, you suffered abuse. We don't want you to relive that here, but could you tell us a little bit about the kind of impact that that's had on you, and this is a big question, throughout your life?
I think it's affected every aspect of my life. I think I went through a phase where I decided it wasn't going to affect me and you shut everything off and you try to live a normal life, but it's very surface and then everything implodes. I live most of my adult life in a state of hypervigilance, always watching over my shoulder because I grew up being told that I would always be found, I would always be got, that I should never tell anybody. And then once you start talking, then you have to become more aware of who's round about you and how you're going to be found and got.
So every aspect of your life is tainted by this?
Yeah, absolutely. Simple things like going to the supermarket is a really massive issue for me, which I struggle to do on my own at all, because you never know who's around the next corner. Supermarket is loads of corners, long things. It's where you bump into everybody you don't want to bump into anyway. But for me, it's not knowing who's around the next corner. Really, for me, that kind of mirrors my external life. Wherever I go, I don't know who I'm going to see or meet.
That must be absolutely terrifying. And yet you're sitting here, you're presenting as someone that looks absolutely as if, you know, you have not a care. This is the problem, isn't it? That people don't see what's happened to you.
You've not got a stookie on your arm. You're not on crutches. You've not got a wheelchair. Your impediments are inside your head and your impediments are in your thinking. I struggle to access logical thinking a lot of the time because of the messages I got as a child were so mixed up. So while I was developing emotionally, the messages that I was receiving were so mixed that I struggle now to regulate emotionally. So I struggle to access logical thinking. I struggle with day-to-day tasks.
Giles, what about you? Does this all ring a bell with you too?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, on the surface, we kind of look like okay people. And
you are okay people.
No, we know that. I always say to people, I've been in this state of constant anxiety since September 1980, you know, every day. And in fact, the only time I'm not anxious is when I'm asleep.
That is your only respite? Do you dream about it?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if it last night actually, and it wasn't very pleasant. So yeah, I do. But generally speaking, you know, bed is a safe place. I've gradually over life removed myself from threats and people. I describe myself as a hermit extrovert, basically. You know, I'm much more comfortable isolated, out the way, and that's kind of affected my work life as well, where I've always been better at doing things on my own. rather than with people.
But you've had to strategize to survive, basically.
I don't even know that I did strategize to survive, no. I didn't actually, until I had children of my own, think that there was anything, there was a cause of the way I am. I thought, it's just me. I'm defective. I'm a twat. You don't know. And then it was when I had my kids and they started going to nursery school and things like that, that it began to kind of sink in that what happened wasn't normal, you know?
The abuse you suffered was not the same as Vicky's. You were physically and emotionally abused as a pupil at Edinburgh Academy. As you said, it happened decades ago. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened to you? But you don't have to relive it.
I'm
being really careful about what I ask you.
Yeah, I know. They say that you know, witnesses should only ever have to give their testimony once, and this is probably the seventh time now. So, but it's important, I think. It appears that in the 80s and the 70s before me, that school in Edinburgh was particularly violent, cruel environment. It's not that now at all.
You were a boarder.
I was a boarder as well, yes, yeah. And I'll never understand why, because the guy's got dementia, because I'd love to know why he acted the way he did.
But this is the teacher that was involved.
The housemaster was a guy called John Brownlee. He's been convicted on 34 counts of cruelty and violence. And by the way, I did not get the worst of it. There were others. And I can link 13 deaths to that man, premature deaths. But we'll come back to that another day. And he was just a psychopath and a sadist and reigned with fear, you know. Racist, he called, and I will use the N-word because that's what he said, he called the one black guy in the house nigger, made him serve at meal times like a butler. Anyone who was physically weak or had asthma was targeted and persecuted for being pathetic, basically. And we were all kind of just beaten gratuitously and randomly for nothing, for just looking at him the wrong way or not laughing at his jokes. And this was a guy who was paid to look after us.
And this could happen at any time of the day. I mean, he would basically come into the dorm and sabotage your sleep.
Oh, he would come in at night, yes, and drag you out at random. I mean, I do not joke when I say it was like a concentration camp. You know, I'm not being disrespectful to people who've gone through that. It really felt like that. And we were in utter fear for years. And it turned out that many others were too.
And the lasting effects, I mean, you could probably list many, 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 but what are the ones that, you know, immediately spring to mind?
Well, the hypervigilance, that's one. People laugh because I've got 6 cameras around my house. And, you know, I was looking into building a watchtower just to kind of keep people away. So I react, massively overreact to anything that's a surprise, like a noise or being approached, or if my daughter drops her phone. I mean, it's completely out of proportion. And this is why I'm angry about child abuse, because people think, oh, we can just stop the abuse. It's not the abuse that's the problem. It's the impact of the abuse over time that's the problem. I can get over being beaten up. You can forget physical things to an extent. And it's more someone's tried to kind of snuff out whatever candle, what spirit you had as a child. And I don't know if you can never get that back, to be honest. That's what's criminal about it. You're ruining lives. It's a bit like when you go up a mountain and you have a compass and you take a bearing. If you get it 1 degree wrong, you might not notice for a bit, but in 10 years' time, it's going to be way off piste. That's the issue. So anxiety, alcohol abuse, substances, you know, total disregard for authority, because they kind of let me down at the start. And I'm afraid also, I mean, it's the thing I have to try and get over now is my views of my parents, to be honest. That's probably the next task.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, there's so much there to deal with.
I mean, there's tons. And like you, it's the sort of, you do think, you're worthless, basically, because you were just used and abused. And Even on the train over today, I had all these voices going, you're a failure, you're worthless, your parents would be ashamed of you. You know, it's just like...
So abuse is not just an event. This is not news to you, Leslie-Ann, as a therapist. What you've heard from Giles and from Vicky, this stuff, this abuse can last a lifetime. Often lasts a lifetime, is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you describe, well, again, we've heard how the trauma might present, but, you know, what does it sound like to you when you've heard two people sitting right beside you and you know their stories?
Well, actually, Giles, I think that your analogy of the compass bearing, I'm going to use that.
I think it's a
really, really helpful analogy for people to understand the impact. Because, you know, Giles, as you said, it's not just about what was done to children or what is done to children. It's about how they then make sense of the world around them. And that takes their compass slightly off bearing, because people who should be safe aren't safe. People that they should be able to approach don't listen properly. And so it does take their compass off bearing. I think that is spot on. And as a result then, like any human being, they adapt and they do have strategies for managing their world. And those strategies on the outside can appear strange.
Like, or, for example?
For example, so with younger children, for instance, they may start to display sexualized behavior. And of course, in the culture that we live in, that would be seen in a really negative way. But instead of us watching the child's behavior and understanding that behavior is a form of communication, we move very quickly into good behavior and bad behavior. And it makes it very challenging.
Almost like it's a choice for a child to act in that way.
Yeah. And often people will say that, you know, the idea, the kind of punitive ideas around behavior, really, as people have grown to have an understanding of attachment theory, how children learn to feel safe. And as people have learned about distress and anxiety and how that shows up in the body and how it shows up in the behaviour and in the thinking, people who have an understanding of that don't use the language of good and bad behaviour, because we know that's just not what this is about. And so then as people go through life, There are really obvious things that will start to happen that, you know, you guys will know when you've listened to other people or spoken to other survivors, that are patterns here of things like not really feeling that you can interpret what safe looks like. So for teenagers, for instance, going into groups of people, their behaviour will sometimes appear quite erratic. On the one hand, they're children having the laugh. The next minute, they're getting angry and they're inflamed. But that's because it's their nervous system. Their nervous system is set to threat. And so that has an impact on their brain and the brain activity. So that then impacts how they interact with people. And again, as people go through their lives, there's this concept or this understanding of social thinning. So because human beings are social creatures, so much of what keeps us well comes from a safe community. Because people have experienced threat, they remove themselves from being around other people. And so this idea of social thinning starts to happen. And so then again, opportunities for repair, opportunities for safety, opportunities for nourishment in a social sense become less and less and less. And then there's all the physical things that happen, because abuse is not just about the feeling of fear. It's about a change in the person's nervous system and their brain. And so before I did this job, I was a physiotherapist, and one of the areas that I specialised in was functional neurological disorders, which is when the nervous system appears intact, but the person might be paralysed from the waist down, or not be able to use one part of their body, or have constant pain. And that is because their nervous system is still in a place where threat feels present, because trauma memories are not stored in the same way that normal memories are. So they pop out all the time, and it feels as if you're re-experiencing. You're not remembering. You're re-experiencing.
Let's ask Vicky and Giles about that, what you've just heard. Is that chiming with you?
Oh, absolutely. You can be walking down a street, you can hear a sound and it transports you. I get to the point where I don't actually see necessarily what's round about me. For me, red walls, cold walls, stone, and that's what I see is round about me. I hear people right in my ear, and I logically understand, sitting talking to you guys, I logically understand that these people are not there, these walls are not there, but at that point they are there. The threat is just as huge. My body betrays me. It reacts in the same way as it reacted then. I'll sweat loads, I'll feel really sick. I get to the point where I want to hurt myself. Self-harm is like huge, because if I'm hurting myself, then these people can't get me, even though they're not actually there.
You did say hypervigilance. That is it, really, isn't it? You're literally wired. You don't know what's going to happen next.
Yeah,
you're so
absolutely
tense. It must be exhausting.
It is. It's really tiring. Yeah. And I think there's a tiredness that's not a sleepy tiredness. There's a tiredness of people, of things. I'm quite often found to be sitting kind of between my bed and the wall. There's a wee space there. You know, if you open the door, nobody can see that you're there. But that's just kind of like to recharge, just to fill yourself back up, because peopling, noise, all sorts of situations can just put you out totally.
Giles, what are your observations about that? How it affects you physically as well as mentally?
It does actually affect you physically. It's strange. I mean, for example, we were strangled quite a lot by Brownlee, and I'm very uncomfortable wearing round neck t-shirts and ties and things like that. It's bizarre. It makes me, even just talking about it, makes me feel uncomfortable about it. And then, I don't know if this is normal, but if I see something painful on TV or online, it actually physically hurts me.
Mm-hmm. Because there's a really famous book called The Body Holds the Score, and it was one of the earliest books around trauma and an understanding of trauma. Mm-hmm. It is your nervous system, mm-hmm. and your nervous system, when these are unprocessed experiences, your nervous system is still running them, your brain is still running them as if it's current. And so that's what you feel, mm-hmm. because, you know, these were physical experiences. And so it's very common for people to have pain in parts of their body, or to feel temperatures. And it's not happening right now, but your brain doesn't know that.
And again, this is stuff that's hidden. Yeah. So you can present as being perfectly fine, but all this stuff is going on in your head and your body. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering about the people that support you, the people that you live with. Can they even get a handle on what is going on, Vicky?
I live with my husband and two teenagers.
Oh, gosh, that's stressful enough, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think just as we've kind of grown together as a family, my kind of little oddities and strange behaviours have kind of become a wee bit of a running joke, and that's allowed us to kind of be there for each other through that.
Are you cool about that? You don't, or
yeah,
does
absolutely.
Does it?
No, absolutely. I think it has to be. I don't want to live in a household where things can't be spoken about. So bringing it up with a bit of humour, even when things are difficult for me, if the kids need to talk about things, my youngest teenager will quite often say, "Oh, Mum, which of you is it today?" You know, which is, you know, before he starts a sentence. So, yeah, we develop our own little strategies, and we develop our own copings, and the support that goes with that falls into place. There's a guilt that comes along with that as well, though, because you're bringing up children and you're living with a partner on a slightly unbalanced scale at times. At times your life can be perfectly normal, if there's ever a normal word. And at other times, for me certainly, life can be a bit unbalanced, and I need more care, more support. And so there's a guilt that goes along with that.
Is that the same for you as well, Giles?
Yeah, I think so too. You kind of sometimes you dominate the family too much. I've always said, well, not always. In the years where I started to understand what had happened, was it's not our fault what happened, but we do have a responsibility to try and not pass that trauma on to others. People who aren't self-aware enough do pass trauma on to others. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's lots of men who are successful in business, or even women as well, and who are a car crash in the home and in the family. And that's the way they express their trauma. They sort of take it out on other people. It's not conscious. It's not deliberate. I mean, I'm lucky in that my wife came from a dysfunctional family background. So she was well trained to accommodate me.
Basically. Does it need a special kind of person to live with you because you've come through this, or just somebody that will listen and understand, someone empathetic?
I think a different level of tolerance is required, and a calmness, definitely. And the ability to kind of step back and let you have your moment and then to come back together again afterwards, yeah. Definitely.
That thing, Leslie-Anne, about guilt. I mean, gosh, as if you're not carrying enough cargo with all the stuff that's happened to you physically, mentally, you're then worrying about the effect it has as it ripples out to the people that are closest to you. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that at the same time as dealing with a horrible trauma?
I don't know how you guys deal with that, but I suppose in the room, in the therapy room, I suppose what we would do a lot of is trying to give people an understanding of what's happening. So I like your idea of what happened to us isn't our fault, but it has become my problem. And so I can either work with that, or it can come out in other ways in my life. But there's maybe something about when people start to have a better understanding of why they are experiencing things in the way that they are, and they are in a safe enough place that they can share that with the people that they live with, then that takes a lot of the angst out of the situation. People are not interpreting it as they've done something wrong, or that, you know, mom or dad is angry with them. But when people have an understanding that, you know, I'm feeling really anxious at the moment, and this is how it presents, and this is what I need to do to soothe and bring myself back. But that requires people to feel safe enough to talk openly about what they're experiencing. And for children who've grown up being harmed, then secrecy is a massive part of that. So their behaviour can appear disruptive or aggressive or unkind because there's no context to it. But when the context is there, when somebody says, look, I'm feeling really overwhelmed and I'm really struggling right now, I need to just go and sit down in another room for 5 minutes, that is very different to, oh my God, would you all stop? So when people feel that they have the right to say, this is too much, I just need to sit down, that changes a lot of the dynamics in the family.
That sounds like a great solution, but how easy is it to get to that mindset where you think, oh, hang on, I'm just going to do that because my therapist has just suggested this would be probably better than me going, wah!
I don't think it's easy at all. I think for me, I wasn't open with my children until I realised that one of them thought that they were going to get whatever was wrong with me as well. Because so then it became, well, actually, as you said, Giles, it becomes your responsibility to stop that happening. So in chatting to my children, and we did it quite casually, providing them with the language to be able to discuss, language that I was happy to use. So I was introducing them to the language that I was happy to use.
Like, give me some examples so that people can understand.
So things like being overwhelmed. I wasn't angry with you. I was actually overwhelmed. It was too much. Teaching them a bit about what forms too much for me. So actually that was really noisy and my head was quite busy at that point. Language like that in my house is used quite a lot.
What about you, Giles?
I suppose one of the ways that it affects our dynamic is, I mean, first of all, my daughters are teenagers, so we never see them anyway. They're always doing other things somewhere else. But I was quite relieved a few years ago when I got a diagnosis, whereas for years I've kind of resisted the idea of that was anything wrong, or I wouldn't take medication. I'm quite a fatalist in that sense. I just thought, I am what I am. And actually, it was quite a relief to get something that I could blame things on rather than
myself. Well, you can
myself.
Pin it to, yeah.
Exactly. So that's been helpful with them to know that, you know, it's a condition, effectively. I suppose the downside is one of the things I can't do is hear other people being unhappy, because it starts to really affect me, basically. I take on their pain. And so thankfully, my wife's very good at the sort of coaching of the girls and steering them through life.
Gosh, that must be very painful because bad stuff happens every day and, you know, worrying stuff. I'm just thinking that sounds, again, exhausting. How do you deal with that and how does it sort of manifest when do you physically feel someone's pain or is it just a feeling?
Pain or stress, everything. Yeah. You know, my father-in-law, anyone with problems, they feel like my own problems. It's really weird. Is that normal? I don't know.
Is that what super empathizer or whatever? What is that?
So I read something, someone told me about the 5 C's of negative thinking. And it sounds pretty damn ruthless, quite frankly, but it's don't commiserate. Okay, fine. Don't criticize. Don't. There's these 5 C's, basically, which basically say, don't care about other people's problems. And that's the way to avoid negative thinking.
But it sounds like it's more than just thoughts for you. Like, you know, this is about experiences and how you are making sense of what you're hearing and seeing around you. And I suppose one of the really common experiences for people who've been harmed as children is around boundaries. It's about understanding where I stop and someone else starts. I don't know that I've ever worked with anybody where that's not the case. And so then that can show up in lots of different ways in their lives. It can be around people finding themselves in relationships that are actually really harmful for them because they're giving all the time. You know, they're only able to respond to other people. They can't really work out what they need and they definitely can't work out how to get what they need. And we've just run a course in our organisation recently and one of the things that we were exploring with people was what they call flows of compassions from compassion-focused therapy. And one of the things that was clear was that most of the people who took part in that course, when they scored, you know, we use different ways to score things. And when they scored their ability to demonstrate compassion towards others, that was pretty high. They were really low scores for generating compassion for themselves and often quite low scores at being able to receive compassion. So they're giving out and giving out because that's what they learned to do to keep themselves safe when they were young. So it's not ever about what I need, because if I say no or I don't like that or don't do that, there's massive consequences. It's not just that you get scolded. So often people who've been harmed have real difficulties having a real sense of where they stop and someone else starts.
Was that your experience?
I think it can be about sense of worth as well. Everyone else is worthy of care, attention, support, compassion. I'm not worthy of that. I was made to be hurt. I was made for other people to do what they will. So why would I look for care or compassion or anything like that? My younger life was spent ensuring other people were safe. So I was at times allowing myself to be hurt because the threat was other people's safety, not
others.
Necessarily my own. So if you grow up with that, then it's really hard to find your own sense of worth as well. And I don't think it always matters who's round about you now and what the messages you're getting now, because the messages that you've had while you were growing are what sticks.
They're stamped on your psyche, aren't they? And for you, Giles, you know, that must be, you know, stuff that you probably concur with. But the whole thing about how survivors sometimes talk about not feeling worthy, but also reckless behaviour sometimes, not caring if they die.
Yeah.
Has this been something that you've come up against?
I still don't. I mean, that's the upside of it. I'm not worried about cancer or anything like that. I'm not scared of death. So that's probably one bonus. I detect from quite a lot of the guys that have met over the last few years that there's a pattern, which is that people put themselves in risky positions. They deliberately seek out danger.
Physically dangerous or mentally dangerous?
I mean, you know, joining the military, going to war zones. And I don't know whether that's because, well, one guy I know in Indiana, he says it's because he doesn't give a damn whether he lives or dies. And he was willing to take the risk. I mean, you were talking about needs and compassion for yourself. I still don't understand those concepts. Someone recently was talking to me. I was on a documentary that we're making about looking after the inner child. And I'm like, what is this inner child? I haven't got a clue who you're talking about. And it's kind of gone, you know? And in terms of needs, yes, you're absolutely right. Boundaries, I'm pretty convinced that people like me are exploited in the workplace and exploited often in relationships with friends. You know, we talk about people who are givers and takers, and we're just like givers. Mm-hmm. And too embarrassed to ask for anything, you know. Mm-hmm. We won't ask for help. We don't ask for help in situations from friends. You're on your own, you know.
Would you like that to change? Do you think you can change that and give yourself some compassion? Because that seems to be something that's so essential.
I'm not bothered. That's the sad thing, isn't it? I don't care.
I think as well, part of the consequences, we're back to this kind of nervous system and brain stuff. And your picture from the start about the compass going off bearing is that things that might otherwise, for somebody who's not had those experiences, feel comforting, it can trigger your threat system for somebody who's had the experiences that you guys have had. So people attempting to come into your space to offer support, it doesn't feel like support. It feels like you're intruding, and that sets your threat system off, and that then impacts how you think about what's going on around you. So it doesn't feel soothing. So you're going to move away from it.
I think it often feels like people are taking control away as well. Yes. For me, control's huge.
Yeah.
So like all sorts of every aspect of life, pretty much.
So but when the GP tries to help.
Yeah, no, that's not.
So how does a professional like Leslie Ann or a doctor or anyone, how do they help? What's the best way for them to approach, given what we've just been talking about?
I think that recognising that we understand, although we maybe don't understand ourselves, we understand ourselves better and we understand the effects. I think for the likes of GPs, community mental health people, they don't necessarily have the depth of knowledge of trauma and just how it gets into every tiny aspect of your life. You can't possibly go for a 6 or an 8 week little
course and it's done.
You're fixed. At that point, you're probably just beginning to be happy to tell them more than, yeah, I've had a good week or I've not had a great week. Trust is a huge, huge issue, and you need time to build and develop relationships with people, and the system's not built for that at all.
That's the problem, isn't it, Leslie Ann? Because, you know, you get a finite amount of time with somebody and then that's that. And, you know, tick box, that's done. I'm not saying that to criticise. It's about resource. It's about just what happens on a daily basis.
It is, but I do think it is driven by a lack of understanding. So I had a really great experience recently when I was meeting with a team from our local health authority of obstetrics and gynaecology team and midwives. And one of the things that they were reflecting on at the end of the training session was, you know, when you look at the stats and you look at the number of women who come through our services, and they were also talking about this for the urology service for men, if you look at the stats and you see actually how common this is, if we just flip to the model and assumed that there was the potential that every woman who's coming into this obstetrics and gynaecology service has had some experience of sexual trauma, then a lot of the harmful experiences wouldn't happen. And the environment would be such that if that was the starting off point, if we just assume that, then the conversations, the freedom for people to say, things have happened to me and, you know, this could be really difficult, then that can make a big difference.
Would that make a difference, Vicky?
Yeah, definitely. When I had my first child, I totally dissociated during the experience. I was asking questions I wasn't getting answers to.
Explain what dissociation is for you.
So I actually gave birth and I was actually, my mind was actually up above watching down. So I saw everything that happened. I felt like I had no control over my body. I certainly didn't feel like I had any control over the conversation. Some of the things that I said were absolutely horrendous. And I was watching myself thinking, oh gosh, this is awful. It wasn't the simplest, it wasn't the most complicated, but it wasn't the simplest of births. But the physical act of people touching me being unaware of what was happening, not not knowledgeable enough that I was welcome to ask questions about what people were doing to me. As far as I was concerned, strangers were coming in and out of a room, poking about at you and giving you instructions. So for me, it was a total loss of control over everything, and I end up in a kind of floating state watching what's happening with
that sounds
control.
Absolutely horrendous and traumatic. Do you replay that in your mind a lot, or is that something that
yes.
is in the past? You can put
no,
it in the past.
No, no,
you
no,
can
that,
never put it in the past.
Well, hopefully at some point. It's a lot calmer now. I can think about it. I can talk about it, and I'm not floating away. For quite a long time, I would have been floating away as I was kind of talking about it, but I can talk about it now. I've luckily got a very patient husband who we've gone over and over that birth time and time again, so that I can understand more of what was actually happening in the room.
You've shared so much today, Giles and Vicky in particular, with your own lived experience, and I'm just thinking, this is a hard question to ask, and I'll ask you afterwards as well, Leslie-Ann. To what extent, having heard that and the lifelong ramifications of what's happened to these guys, can you ever be said to fully recover, Giles?
Someone once said you can't unscramble an omelette. I know it's a bit of a weird metaphor, but I don't know. I'm not... honest answer from me, no, I don't think you can. And that's why it's criminal. It's, you know, you get one shot at life, and I think it's too much to untangle fundamentally. You can pretend on the surface and you can function normally, but someone somewhere has extinguished your soul, I suppose, to an extent.
Vicky?
I think for me, for years, I looked to recover, to be fixed. I saw myself as fundamentally broken, looking to be put back together with no cracks showing, and life would go on and I would be a normal person. Now, I don't think I'm looking to recover. I think I'm looking to learn to live with my mind the way it is, be able to change what I can change, and find strategies to be able to live in a reasonable manner, in a functional manner.
But also to thrive and have joy in your life.
To have some future and to have some things to look forward to be able to embrace a future with my family, absolutely, is what I'm looking for. But I don't think I'm looking for those cracks to disappear anymore.
Leslie-Ann, nodding along.
Yeah, I just think it's a really lovely analogy. And I think there's this idea that I have said this to clients often, you know, there is actually nothing wrong with you. You have responded exactly as any child or adult should who's experienced what you've experienced. So it's not about regrowing a nervous system or a brain and making it as if it's just been born. There is nothing wrong with you, but things have been done to you that are wrong, and that has changed things in the same way as you can't unbreak a leg. You can't reset a nervous system and a brain completely, but you can find ways and strategies that allow you to feel safe again. And then from there, that sense of safeness is then what allows you to live your life in the way that you would choose to live it.
Can I ask a difficult one now about that sense of safeness and how things can just get disrupted or triggering thoughts or triggering things maybe in the news? And there was a recent news case where there was a sex abuse gang in the west of Scotland, and they were given heavy jail sentences. And because I knew I was coming to talk to you guys today, I was thinking, how does that feel when you hear about an abuse-related case in the media? Does that set you back, or do you try to avoid it? What is the strategy and what are the feelings? And I don't know who wants to start with that.
I think for me, it depends where I am with my own mental health story, whether I follow these stories or whether I totally avoid them when I'm able to follow them. I think probably look at them slightly differently from other people. Yeah, absolutely. Thank goodness that these people get the sentences that they get. Wish they were longer. I'm not convinced that there are really heavy sentences for the crimes. But for me, I find my brain goes more to thinking about the amount of people that have let down the victims, the amount of opportunities that have been missed in a child's life to help them to ask them questions, to listen beyond the words of the answers, to look for the signs. That's where I'm going. How many people are seeing something and having no response to it?
Well, let's turn now to how do we make all this a bit better, because it can never be perfect, any system. But, you know, do you think, for example, even the first instance, Leslie-Ann, we've got better at spotting the signs of abuse in society at large? You think we're more attuned to it? We can recognise, there might be a problem with that child, that adult, whatever.
I think that people are trying, but I think that it's still very early days. You know, we still have this, for instance, you used the word binary earlier around things being good or bad. And so because when it's harm to children, people are groomed, people are manipulated and coerced. And it's not just the children. It's the abusers. The case that happened where they were sentenced recently, one of my reflections on that was that in some ways, it's not the images that were used were very specific. And the images all looked like, you know, these were people who were drug users, or, you know, they pick their pictures.
You're talking about the perpetrators, the images that were used in the media.
And again, so then you look at them, you go, oh, yeah, they look like a bad person. But actually, you know, the majority of people who harm children are, it's happening in their homes, it's happening in their churches, it's happening in their community groups by good, upstanding members of the community. And so while I think that people are perhaps, teachers and social workers are perhaps getting better at understanding what's the behaviour trying to tell me, I think that the stumbling block still is, yeah, but not in my town.
How is that going to change then? Because that sounds like a very human, a sad human frailty that we can't see past. We start to see that's what somebody looks like that does this stuff. How do we get past that?
I think we get past it by conversations like this. I think we get past it by people who have been harmed being supported, and just people actually learning that this happens everywhere. This happens in every community. It's not a different kind of person who does this. It is people that do this. And they target children, and the families that say, not in our town, their children are much more vulnerable. The families who won't talk about sex and relationships, their children are far more vulnerable. And so the whole looking away, pretending that it doesn't happen here, that's the biggest thing that we can do to change, when we can acknowledge that it happens everywhere and it happens in good, upstanding communities, then that actually will go a long way to creating a space that's much safer for children to say, I didn't like that person. So when a child tells you they don't like somebody, whether they do it by being, in inverted commas, rude, or by taking themselves away all the time, we need to just trust the kid's gut. It's about, you know, it's about how they experience this person. And we've not been good at doing that. We want our children to be well-behaved and polite and, you know, do the right thing.
And nobody wants to believe it's happening right under their nose in plain sight. And yet, both of you have, you know, suffered from that, literally quite flagrantly, but happening in a so-called reasonable environment, nice, possibly privileged environment sometimes. Yeah. What's your thought?
I mean, on a positive note, I was in at the NSPCC in London a couple of months ago and met with the lady who does the schools programme. And I found that quite a difficult meeting, because they do so much good stuff now with young kids, speaking to them in age appropriate, if it feels wrong, it is wrong, all that kind of stuff. And I just had flashbacks to the school that I was at and the sort of terrifying, draconian atmosphere led by sadists, basically. So I think society's moved on a bit. Bullying between kids, to me, is the future problem, more than abuse by adults in a working environment. Abuse at home, I mean, sexual abusers are fixated and clever. I had a meeting with a guy who actually helps the FBI profile paedophiles, and it was very eye-opening about the techniques they use to so like you were saying earlier, they get jobs where it's not possible that so-and-so could abuse children. He's a bastion of...
He's such a lovely man.
He's such a nice man. They groom the world around them.
Yes.
So they'll find a way, whatever happens, but at least we're now more sensitive to it, I think. And there are measures to make society even more sensitive to, and able to pick up the signals. You know, and there's new legislation coming in later this year in England and Wales, and we've been talking to the Scottish government about improving child protection, putting in things like mandatory reporting. Mm-hmm. Regardless of its complexity in terms of implementation, it's absurd that anyone was debating introducing measures that would improve the safety of children over time. Because when you were small and I was small, everything worked against us, you know.
It was a different society as well, because adults could say anything. I remember going to school and getting blamed for something, come back, my mum and dad didn't believe me. That's the point. It was a different time. Is it better now? I mean, you're saying, yes, there is cause for hope there, Giles. Do you think it's better now that people are more prone to seeing the other side and saying, do you know what, that child might actually be right, that person?
I hope it's better. I think there's a lot more open discussion about things. I think people notice a lot more, know a lot more what to look for. But it's whether they're going further than gossiping at the school gate and discussing over their coffee and cakes. Are people willing to go further than that and actually do something to help to stop it or not? I'm not 100% convinced that they are yet. I think there's probably a fear that the anonymity that they say that reporting will give is not necessarily as anonymous. So there's fear of repercussions, things like that.
And that outweighs the fear of being right about
there's
something
happening. You don't want
happening.
Any bad to come to you. Yeah. That wee child will just suffer because nothing bad should come to me, you know. I find it difficult, but I do think that things have changed, but I don't think they've gone as far as they need to.
What do you think has to happen as a professional, Leslie-Ann, next? What can the profession do to help survivors more? What can change? What's within your gift to change it?
That feels like a big question, because it feels there's so many layers to what makes children vulnerable to people who would harm them. Part of it is definitely about conversations in different environments. So conversations with the medics. I was asked to do a presentation for a safeguarding organisation within the Catholic Church recently, and just having very direct conversations, just talking about things as they actually are, and helping people to understand that wherever there's a power dynamic, so it can be external things like teachers and children, it can be parents, it can be older siblings, it can be extended family, wherever there's a power dynamic, there's the opportunity for harm. And just helping people to understand that fundamentally that's the risk. Power dynamics are everywhere. They have to be. I'm not saying that there's anything fundamentally wrong in them, but there is the risk of harm when there is a power dynamic. And if we can just be honest about that, then that can help us to open things out.
And how does that candour, those conversations, go down? Are people receptive to it now? Or do you think they're just paying lip service to say, yeah, you know, we're over that. We've got that. We understand.
So when I did the presentation for the Catholic Church recently, it was the Scottish Conference. And I was delayed starting the next one because of the number of people that came up. And I had clergy and religious and lay people there, not all of them from the UK even, just genuinely coming up and saying, I'd like to learn more about this. See this thing that you put up, where can I learn more about that? So there's a shock. There was definitely, both times I ran the presentation, there was real shock in the room and discomfort and disbelief on some level. But then people were genuinely like, oh, okay. Especially when they can see the context, where they don't just see it as the big bad guy in the corner or the really badly behaved person, but actually when you can see the context and the culture behind it, and how that can then make people vulnerable. So how do we talk about that? Because where we're not talking about child abuse, we're not talking about domestic violence, we're not talking about bullying. You know, this is it's all part of that picture of power dynamics and control. And being able to have these really candid conversations, we have to be able to just get used to being uncomfortable, because the people who've gone through what they've gone through, they were way more uncomfortable than me taking a deep breath and thinking, oh, people are not going to be happy here. And actually, that's not really been my experience.
Well, let me turn to you first, Vicky, and then to you, Giles, and say, what needs to happen for us all, not just therapists, but for society, to support abuse survivors better?
People to listen and to hear and to accept that as a survivor, you might be ready to give a little of yourself and have some support with that. And then you might need space, and then it might be later on till you're willing to give more. You don't need to give your whole story in order to have help and to have people to care, for people to listen to what you do and how you behave as well as what you say.
Giles.
Talk to other survivors, and then you find out for the first time in your life that it's not just you. We're carbon copies of each other in many ways, and although look very different on the surface. There are a lot of people bandy around the phrase trauma informed, and they kind of sort of rubber stamp their paperwork with that, and it's a bit like saying we're eco-friendly. Mm-hmm. I've met very few people who are genuinely trauma-informed, as in understand the lifelong impact, that it's not just about a beating that took place or a sexual assault back in the 1980s or the 1990s. It's actually about the damage done to the person over time. There are too many processes that aren't suitable, really, for dealing with people like us, who, you know, to avoid re-traumatizing us. So, for example, one is, you know, the court system. When you go to court, we went in to Brownlee's trial. We went from the position of no one's going to believe us because they didn't first time round, and we're just going to be humiliated. Mm-hmm. And he was convicted on everything, and I was gobsmacked about that.
So, how did that feel?
Weird, because it was kind of good, but also quite depressing, because it made it real. Mm. It made, there are times in my life where my brain's gone, just pretend that actually you just made it all up, it never really happened, you know, and that's maybe some kind of security thing, you know. And I'm good at telling stories as well. I that's what I kind of did for a living to an extent. So I'm suspicious of myself. And then the minute the man was convicted, I mean, even up until that point, I still viewed the court hearing as a pantomime. It's people in wigs and it's not real.
Surreal, actually.
It's surreal, yeah. And that's one of the issues with losing your faith in other people. It means you lose faith in systems as well. And I pretended to be in court and go along with it, but it's an artificial construct, the whole thing. So, I think things gradually will improve in terms of how they deal with people like us. And I think, you know, if people are going to start talking about trauma-informed, they really need to do the work on it, not just say, we've done an hour on a training course. And some people will never be the right people to deal with victims. And, you know, it's like I'm not front of house in a hotel, for example, you know. To say that we're all trauma-informed would be misleading. And, you know, the lawyers who get involved in everything, probably the least compassionate, sensitive people. And I've met one who actually gets it because he was abused when he was a child. You know, we're a different species, I think.
Is that the point? I was wanting to stop there, but now you've made me think about something. Is it the case that you have to have been in that position to really, really, really get it?
I don't think so. I think you have to be able to have empathy, and you have to be able to be of somebody who understands that your experiences are not the experiences of everyone else. You need to be able to look below the surface, and you need to be able to listen. It's something I'll just never get away from. Listen, look and listen. I don't think you have to have been there.
I have been looking and listening to you three, and it's been absolutely fascinating. And I'm so grateful that you've shared some really painful stuff today and be very, very candid. And I've learned a lot. I hope this is helpful to other people. But thank you to you all, to Vicky, to Giles, to Leslie-Ann. Great to have you here today.
Thank you very much.